You may be owed some money. After 911 and 411, call 541. That's 727-541-1741. Call Gulfstream Motorsports for a diminished value report. Due to my 28 years experience in the auto salvage business, I'm very good with wrecks. So if your car's been involved in a wreck, call me for a diminished value report. Call 727-541-1741. You may be owed some money for the lost value of your repaired vehicle. And visit us at GulfstreamMotorsports.com.
Looking for car shows? Then look no further than flacarshows.com. On your computer or on your mobile device, flacarshows.com is a comprehensive list of automotive events, plus videos and news articles. Whether you're looking for car shows, cruise-ins, meetups, automotive festivals, cars and coffees, or anything else relating to an internal combustion engine, then this is a site for you. Check it out online or on your phone at flacarshows.com.
How you been, Cannonball?
Great, Brian. Seems like old times, don't it?
I'm looking for a good, solid body for my Hemi, you know? Something I can shoehorn in and run.
Are you gonna build? Go fast?
If I'm gonna rebuild, I might as well go fast.
Right.
Can't dance. Hi.
Yeah, it's good to see someone drive one of these in here. Most of them have to be towed.
I'm looking for a chassis which I want to stick a big Hemi engine in. You got anything?
Cheap.
Cheap. Cheap.
Going racing?
Yeah.
Pre-war Willie's rides up like a cutter through ice.
Oh, it'd be a miracle just to see one again.
Want to see one?
Oh, you see one every now and then sitting in an old garage in Rollo, Missouri, or by the side of the road in West Lafayette.
Or hidden in a junkyard in Lyons, California. Come here. Come on, come on.
It moved.
But you ain't gonna sell it, right?
Sonny Munn offered me 1,000 once.
I'm gonna race him.
Everybody kind of lost interest in these old hot rods.
Right. How about your old Dodge body? You have enough left to bail?
Sure, I'd like to see it run again. Especially against Munn. Let's talk. If you beat the Munns, it's yours. Free.
Set the Wayback Machine.
Yes, sir, Mr. Peabody.
This is Bill Warner of the Amelia Island Concours d'Elegance, and you are listening to Nostalgic Radio and Cars.
Okay, listeners, welcome. You're tuned in to Nostalgic Radio and Cars, and I'm your show host, Robert, right on your computers and Google Tantalk 1340.com. And you can see us live here in the studios in downtown Clearwater. Don't forget to check out our website, GulfstreamMotorsports.com, where you can find out all about us. And if you've missed any of our shows, check out NostalgicRadioandCars.com. Good evening, Bobby. How are you?
I'm doing pretty well. How about yourself?
So you're back in the command center over there.
Yeah, driving for today.
Yeah. Good, good. Okay. Well, I'd like to take the opportunity to dedicate this show to a really good friend of mine that unfortunately left a little too soon. Years ago, I used to work with Mike Flynn. We're old buddies from way back when. The classic Ford Chevy thing. He was Chevy, I was Ford. Then he went to Mopar. Then he went to Oldsmobile. Then he went to Pontiac. Back to Mopar, back to Chevy. But anyway, I'm still Ford. But Mike and I were really good friends, and he started Hollywood Wheels back in like around 2010, 11, 12. And we had some really, really great times, and I worked with him for many, many years. I knew his dad. I knew the whole family. And there's going to be a big celebration of life this weekend for him. But, you know, Mike and I go way back. And he was a guest on our show many, many times. I worked with him at Hollywood Wheels. I worked with him doing consignment. And he gave me an opportunity to be the commentator on his auction stage. And that was just, I mean, a real treat. And unfortunately, he had some health issues and they got the best of him. But nonetheless, so I'd like to dedicate this show to Mike Flynn, my good old buddy. And a big shout out to Kelly and Flo and everybody else, his dad, Iron Man, and the whole family, just a great bunch of guys, and he will be missed. Mike was kind of I don't want to use the word futurist, but I mean he was kind of ahead of his time. You know, when we did the first auction, all Porsche auction at Amelia Island, we were doing auctions at the Okeechobee Convention Center in West Palm Beach. I think 2011, 12, 13, 14, or 13. We skipped a year. Set up at Amelia, so Amelia. I think we were 2015, 16, 17. I got a cute story. I'm going to share it with everybody this week, but. It's kind of really cool, but his auctions were done very, very professionally. I mean, Mike was a fanatic about it, and the whole team. I mean, everybody just worked collectively together to put together a really, really good auction. And he always referred to it as a boutique auction, and it wasn't like there was 500 cars, 1,000 cars, or anything like that. There was basically 100 cars, 125 cars. Some cases, maybe even just a little of that, but the thing was is they were really super quality cars, and that's kind of what makes these auctions kind of really special. And Mike was kind of like going along those lines, so we were kind of like league wise, I'd say we weren't RM or Goody necessarily, but we were really pretty close. So we were on that. So we were above Barrett, or not Barrett necessarily, but Barrett has some really, really good cars. But I mean, we're up in the top echelon there of auction houses, you know, with the quality and level of cars, because we had a lot of European sports cars. I remember we had an F40 there one time, sold for $1.3 million. We had another car that was really special, and I had the opportunity to appraise a car for Mike, and it was the very first 57 Eldorado Barretts convertible, the pilot car, which is really, really interesting. I mean, a lot of research went into making sure that car was real, but it was owned by a gentleman by the name of Jim Rundlinger out of, I think, Minnesota. And he not only did he have the first one, 57 Eldorado Barretts convertible, but he also had the last production 57 Eldorado Barretts. I never saw that. I saw the car at a show one time, but I never did the appraisal on it. But I did do the 57. And but it was a beautiful, stunning car, and the restoration was just like exquisite, totally over the top. But the thing that made that restoration so special was all the detail. They really, truly made an effort to. They got original. They were able somehow to obtain original paperwork and pictures of the vehicle in the process of being. You know, prototypes or pilot cars are generally pre-production cars. Okay. And so there's a lot of handwork that's done, you know, fitting, test fitting, you know, they've got, you know, their preliminary molds are not exactly, and stampings, you know. There's a lot of fit and finish, and they're better than what a production car would be because they're hand fit, they're hand assembled. And so this car was really, really exquisite from that standpoint, but the fact that they did all they researched all the details on the assembly process so that they could basically replicate it, so the car was pretty much 100% original. I mean, we use the term 100% original, but they tried to do it as close to a factory setup as a factory build as the way it was when it rolled off the assembly line and was a show car in New York at the New York Auto Show in 1957. So, but Mike eventually got into Porsches. We did it in 2015. We did the all Porsche auction. Well, now the Mike was a regular car dealer as well, so he had a regular dealer license. So we all used to go to Mannheim, and Mannheim would have basically an all Ford sale, and all Chevy sale, and all Mercedes sale, and all BMW sale. But nobody's ever done that with collector cars. So Mike's concept was, let's do an all Porsche sale in the vintage car world, which was actually a pretty cool idea. So, and we did it at the Omni Hotel up in Fernandina Beach, which is basically Amelia Island. And we had the convention center that we used for that was part of the Omni Hotel, and it was stunning. I mean, it was really, really impressive. And that aspect of it was every bit as good as RM, in my opinion, because RM basically used the convention center hall, kind of like facilities of the Ritz-Carlton. And so the presentation was amazing. And the way it was all orchestrated. And then, of course, that was just all the Porsche stuff. And then at the other ballroom that we had, because there were split up in two big ballrooms. We had foreign cars that were non-Porsche. You had Ferraris, Mercedes-Benzes, BMWs, Lamborghinis, again, plenty of Ferraris. But we had a lot of Chryslers, we had Lincolns, we had Cadillacs, we had Corvettes, we had just everything. You know, we even had Triumphs and MGs and vintage race cars, all kinds of stuff. And but it was just, it's kind of hard to explain, but I'm touched now because I'm reflecting on it, and we had a really, really, really good time. And anyway, Mike will be missed, so here's a big shout out to Mike, and hopefully he's watching us here, tuned in on the radio in the sky, as I say. Anyway, so what we got, if you want, we're going to get back to the show here in a second, and we're going to talk about, we have a really interesting guest coming on, and who also is kind of involved with auctions and collector car data collecting and things of that nature. So this kind of all ties in. And this gentleman also had been in some of our auctions. So there's a connection here. You know, all my shows, the music, the promo liners, there's always a connection there and a correlation to all that stuff. It all kind of ties in. But anyway, as far as collector car shows, if you want to find out what's going on in the state of Florida, definitely check out flacarshows.com. This month, I think in a week or two, is the HSR Fall Historic Vintage Road Races at Road Atlanta. I was up there earlier for the Walter Mitty this year, and they have another one. And Road Atlanta is a really cool track. I mean, that's where I got my racing license in Road Atlanta 1990. Yeah, I think that's when it was. And so I kind of have a thing for that track. I like it specifically. I mean, I definitely like Sebring, and I definitely like Daytona. I actually like Sebring a lot because that's the one track I've probably been on more than anything else when I used to club race. But it's flat. And Road Atlanta is got topos. It's up and down and around and a left and a right and a this and a that. And it reminds me very much of California, like Laguna Seca or Sears Point road racing tracks, because there's some topography there, and that makes it kind of interesting, because a car does all kinds of weird things when it's traveling down a road. It's kind of like traveling down these country roads that you have up there in the Carolinas, which check out fastlanetravel.com, because we're going to be doing a spring trip into the Carolinas, and we're going to be doing a fall one as well, and that's going to be called the Moonshine Festival. And so if you guys want to find out more about that, definitely check out fastlanetravel.com. By the way, they're Peter, our Treffenmeister. Shout out to Peter and the team at Fastlane Travel. He's busy giving a tour. He's doing three tours back-to-back, two 50th anniversary tours, and then a Porsche Fall Treffen gathering. And so he'll be over there for 6, 7, 8 weeks. But it's a driving touring. Driving tour trip thing. Stays at some really great hotels and some great roads and great dining and camaraderie and all that other good stuff. So anyway, on that note, I think what we're going to do is play a song. And on this day in 1968, Elvis, I always liked Elvis Presley when I was a kid. Of course, one of my favorite movies that he did, two of them actually, was Spin Out and Viva Las Vegas. But on this day in 1968,
September 3rd, 1968.
Yeah, his song
A Little Less Conversation was released.
A Little Less Conversation, yeah, and I think it was one of the theme song to one of his movies that had the same title, right, if I remember correctly?
Correct.
Yeah, so
anyway. Have A Little Less Conversation right now. A little more music.
I think that's a good idea. All right, on that note, you are tuned into Nostalgic Radio and Cars Don't Touch That Dial. We'll be right back.
Hey, a little less conversation, a little more action, please. All this aggravation is satisfaction in me. A little more bite, a little less spark. A little less fight, a little more spark. Close your mouth and open up your heart, and baby, satisfy me. Satisfy me, baby. Baby, close your eyes and listen to the music and dig to the summer breeze. It's a groovy night and I can show you how to use it. Come along with me and put your mind at ease. Hey, a little less conversation, a little more action, breeze. All this aggravation is satisfaction in me. A little more bite, a little less spark. A little less fight, a little more smart.
your coat and let's start walking. Come on, come on.
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 Don't procrastinate, don't articulate. Girl, it's getting late. You just didn't wait around. A little less conversation, a little more action. All this aggravation ain't satisfaction in me. A little more bite, a little less bark. A little less bite, a little more spark. Close your mouth and open up your heart. Baby, satisfy me.
This is McKeel Haggerty, and you are listening to Nostalgic Radio and Cars. So get out there and keep driving all those cool cars.
Okay, we're back, and you're tuning into Nostalgic Radio and Cars, and time to introduce our special guest for the evening. Gentleman's been a friend of mine, and he's a hobbyist, a collector, car enthusiast, but he's also the founder of Collector Car Auction Reports at rickcarey.com. I'm delighted to welcome to the show this evening, Rick Carey. Correct me if I said that right, Rick, old buddy.
Close enough.
How are you doing this evening?
I'm good. Thank you very much, Robert.
Well, I'm delighted to have you on the show. We've talked about this for years, and you are kind of like the guru when it comes to collector car data collecting. Would that be the fair statement?
That's a fair statement, yeah. I've been doing this for over 30 years. Which is sort of hard to imagine, but that's the fact.
Let me ask go ahead.
Going to auctions, looking at cars, writing a brief description of equipment and condition, and then analyzing the results after the sale, whether it's expensive or not expensive, or a good value, or just plain market. So I've got a lot of data.
Would you say, now you also provide data to the Haggerty Collector Car Guide group, right?
That's right, to the valuation team at Haggerty Insurance, yeah.
Okay, so that's Dave Kenny and those guys, right?
That's correct.
Okay, so you do Dave Kenny's work for him, basically.
Well, you know, he spends so much time keeping the Haggerty Price Guide up to date that he doesn't have much time to actually go out and look at cars anymore. So I guess he sort of depends upon me.
So how did you get involved in this aspect of the industry, so to speak?
I have a very simple answer to that.
Sure.
And that is that I failed at everything else I tried, and I wanted to do something that I was good at, that I enjoyed, that got me interested enough that I got up every morning and I went to strange places and wandered around in the heat and the rain and the cold and looked at cars and talked to people. And that's how I ended up where I am. And by golly, I've been able to do it for 30 years. So I guess I must have chosen the right course.
What did you do before that? What's your, by profession, what is your occupation, or what's your vocation, so to speak?
I didn't really have one. I did a number of things. I was involved in first of all, after getting out of the Navy, I was in the finance business, worked for a company, equipment leasing and financing, and then worked for a commercial bank as a commercial lending officer, and then said, no, I want to build something, I want to do something, not just sit here and make decisions for other people. And so I went to work in manufacturing and worked for a company that made cabinets and chassis and stuff like that out of sheet metal for the electronics industry in New England back in the early days of the small computer, long before the personal computer came out, and got them into molding cases out of plastic. Started a plastic molding operation up in Wolfboro, New Hampshire that still exists today, and did that for a number of years. Had a few years working with a venture capital fund, a regional one in New England, and then kind of looked around and said, nope, I'm not having fun doing this. It's not particularly rewarding, and I want to do something that's fun and that I'm good at. So here I am.
Well, now, where did your passion for cars begin? Was that something from your teenage days?
And oh, then, God. That was from long before that.
Oh, really?
My dad, as often is the case, my dad enjoyed cars. He wasn't really a big hobbyist, but he enjoyed cars. He had a 34 Ford station wagon, Woody station wagon, before I was able to drive. And then miraculously, the year that I turned 15 and began to look forward to getting my driver's license at 16, he bought a 1953 Jaguar XK120.
Ooh.
And that's what I learned to drive in, and that's what I took my driving test in when I turned 16 on my 16th birthday. I passed my driving test in the XK120.
That is cool. That is cool.
Yeah, it's, you know, I got into, I had a 57 Chevy Bel Air convertible for years, and sold that when I was stationed in Hawaii with the Navy, and bought a 1967 Alfa Romeo Giulia Sprint GTV, and I've been sort of on the Alfa Romeo track ever since.
Interesting. I sent you an email that I actually have a friend of mine that are a referral friend, acquaintance, and he's up in Alabama, and he has a 1964 Alfa Romeo Giulia Spider Veloce that was a race car since day one. I think I might have mentioned a little bit of that on my show last week. And it was owned by Otto Zipper, a well-known California guy. And so I have to do evaluation on that. And it's got logbooks, I mean, and said some other notable drivers throughout the years from the East Coast to the West Coast, or West Coast to East Coast and stuff. So when you mentioned Alfa Romeos, I just thought I'd throw that out there because the one you're talking about, it was a Spider GTV, the boat tail?
No, it was a...
Or the sedan?
Coupe, 2+2 coupe.
Oh, okay. 2+2? Oh, you mean like the little step nose?
Yeah, it was a step nose.
Oh, I think that is just such a cool looking. That's like, you know what? I don't like to use this analogy sometimes, but that's a handsome looking car.
Yes, it is. And there's one sitting in my driveway.
Well, that's a good thing, yeah. So now they came with what, 1300s and 1600s?
Well, the Giulia had a 1600.
Okay.
And 115 horsepower, roughly. There was a European model, which was a GT Junior, which had a 1300, 1290 cc engine.
Okay, right.
And they did that because there was a tax break that they could get if the car was under 1300 cc's. So in Europe, they built a GT Junior. And then, of course, they went on to go to 1750, which was 1800 cc engine, and then ultimately to the
2 liter. Right.
Yeah.
All right. So with the Spiders, the early ones that had the small motors, they were called Giuliettas, and then they became Giulias if they had the bigger motor. Did they do the same thing with the sedans like yours? So they were called, they didn't call them Giuliettas, they call them Juniors?
Well, the body style changed.
Oh, okay.
The early cars up till 63, 64. Were a Pininfarina body style, and the Spider evolved then into what we know today as the Duetto, which is the boat tail,
right?
Which also was a Pininfarina design, and the
sedan was
sedan. It's a sprint coupe. It's a two door.
They were Bertone's, right?
They were Bertone.
Okay.
Yeah.
I just think that's just a good-looking car. I happened to live in Europe back in the day in the 60s and throughout the early 70s, and some friends of my dad had one of those. One of them had a Lancia Fulvia, and the other one had the Alfa Stepnose. And I remember they were fighting, well, I want to take you for the ride up the hill, and then you can ride with him in the Lancia on the way down the hill. And my mom was a nervous wreck because the cars were fast, and you know they drive like madmen over there. And these were young guys in their 20s back in the day. And the Lancia I thought was a very good looking car, but the Alfa just basically trumped it. It was just a good looking car.
It's a great design, and it really has stood the test of time very well. And in fact, if you look at other cars of the era, Ferraris, Maseratis, a lot of them shared similar lines to the, particularly the greenhouse on the Bertone Alfa GTV.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It was, it was largely emulated. I have a great story about living and driving in Europe.
Go ahead.
Years and years ago,
mm-hmm.
I went to a Christie's auction in Basel, Switzerland.
Oh.
And I flew to Milan, and Alfa lent me an Alfa to drive. And so I got on the Autostrada, and I drove to the Swiss border and got on the Autostrada in Switzerland, because they had to drive all the way across Switzerland to get to Basel.
Mm-hmm.
And the Swiss, it didn't really strike me until I made the return trip, and I'm driving back through Switzerland. And the speed limits on the Autostrada go up and down, depending on the conditions and where you are. And everybody in Switzerland would drive exactly at the speed limit. And so the speed limit would change, and everybody would speed up. And the speed limit would drop, and everybody would slow down. And so you built up this group of cars that you were all driving together with, because everybody was speeding up and slowing down at the same time. I got to the border crossing into Italy and, you know, went through customs, which you had back then because it was pre-Schengen, duty-free. Went through customs and got on the Autostrada in Italy, and all of these people that I had driven with all across the country of Switzerland turned into absolute nutcases. They lost their minds. It was a four-lane road, two lanes each direction. They were driving down the shoulder of the road to get around trucks and people going slow. They completely changed their mindset when they went from Switzerland to Italy. It was marvelous to see and great to be part of.
Well, now let me ask you this. Okay, so when I was over there in the 60s and 70s, there was no speed limit on the Strada or the Autobahn, even in Austria. But when you were there, because I heard that sometime in the mid-70s, they started enacting a speed limit.
Yes.
Okay, so was there a speed limit on the Autostrada back then?
Yes, nobody cared about it at all.
Nobody cared. Okay.
It was very Italian. There was a speed limit, but nobody cared.
Okay. Interesting. So tell us about Basel. What was that auction like? And what year was this now? What year are we talking?
Oh, God. This was Christie's auction at the Monteverdi sale. This was the Monteverdi collection in Basel, Switzerland.
As in Monteverdi, the cars that were manufactured? Oh, really?
Yes. Yeah, he had... There were examples of many of the different models of Monteverdi, and then a few cars that were his that were not Monteverdi in the auction. So, and it was just probably 1993, 94. I don't remember exactly. It was back at a time in the auction world, in the car collecting world, where we didn't know what cars were worth. The bottom had fallen out of the market in 1990, 1991.
Mm-hmm.
And for the longest period of time, cars didn't change hands because nobody knew what they were worth. There was no point of reference. And that's part of the reason why I started writing auction reports, because there were so few reliable sources of information that I figured there was an opportunity to provide a consistent, intelligent, and informative and entertaining description of the cars that crossed the block. And some were sold, and most were not at that time, but some were sold and established a benchmark of sorts. But that was part of the charm of that sale, was that it was the first place I ever went. I stayed in a little hotel, and I went out in the evening, and I was walking down these really delightful tree-shrouded streets, and came upon something on a post on the side of the road. Looked like a little mailbox. I looked at it, and it had plastic bags out there on the street for people to pick up when they needed them, to pick up after their dogs. That was one of my overriding memories of being in Switzerland, is you actually had dog poop bags available in boxes on the street. It also was an opportunity for me to cross the border into France and go to the Maluz Museum, the Schlumpf Collection in Maluz, which, of course, is absolutely, totally famous and full of some of the great cars of the period, particularly the great Bugattis. And I had a chance to walk through that museum for a day. I was so poor at the time that I had changed a little money into francs, and I had a few francs left. And before I left France, I took all of my change and my bills, whatever I had, and I went to a gas station, and I bought just exactly that much gasoline so that I would end up with no French francs to bring back home.
Well, now that's interesting because, all right, so I know I started going to the auctions. Well, I'd been to some miscellaneous auctions here and there and stuff, but I really started kind of getting into it when I went in, probably in the mid to late 80s at Scottsdale, only because my cousin lived out there, and a friend of mine from here said, you need to go check out the Barrett Jackson auction. So I used to go to the Barrett Jackson auction. And at the time, that was the only one in Phoenix, you know. And then, of course, you know, now they have Gooding, RM, there was Russo, and a few other ones that were there, Bonhams, and so on. So my question would have been, didn't the auction houses maintain data records that people could access, or was that all kept kind of proprietary? And then what you do, basically, is you put it out there for, and I'm guessing this is probably before the days of Sports Car Market and Haggerty's price guide, correct? When you started
way
it?
Before, yeah.
Okay.
Way before. Keith Martin was still publishing the Alfa Romeo market letter at that time.
Okay. And so what got him, so you actually can sit there and say that I kind of started this whole concept.
No, not really.
No?
No, the reliable, informative, consistent auction reports I credit to somebody you may never have heard of called Dave Brownell, who was from Vermont and worked for Old Cars Weekly.
Oh, yes, I remember Old Cars Weekly. Jeez, yeah, that was a...
And that was, and one of the reasons I started was I was looking at Old Cars Weekly trying to figure out what the auction reports said, what they had in their auction reports, and I realized that the information they had was incomplete.
Yes.
There was no idea of what the condition of the car was. It was just 1957 Chevrolet Corvette sold for $5,800. And you had no idea whether it was the original engine, whether it was a rust bucket, whether it had fuel injection or a four-barrel carburetor. And there was no way really to establish a consistent judgment of the value of that car from the kind of information that they had. And that's one of the reasons that I started doing this.
So you basically have a description of the vehicle. So in other words, let's just say you take an Alfa Romeo. So you've got a driver quality car that's got, you know, 80,000 kilometers. Let's just say it was an export car, European car, because many of them were. And, you know, they were prone to rust. Okay, so you can say it had rust repair. Versus you could find, you would have another one that you saw at an auction that was a low mileage car, clean car, exported early in its life, never exposed to, you know, bad weather, so it was a fairly solid car. And then there might be a $3,000 to $5,000 difference in back then, okay, in the values of the vehicle. And your description would basically highlight the pros and cons of both vehicles, correct?
Yes, exactly. That's what I try to do.
Okay,
is to make a difference. It, you know, today it's difficult to do that because so many of these cars have been restored, and even if they're haphazardly restored, they're still better than they were when somebody bought them. The rust has been repaired or at least covered up, and you're trying to make, again, you know, at an auction, you don't usually get to hear the car run. You don't get to look at it very closely. You don't get to see underneath it unless you get down on the ground and prowl around with a flashlight. And so you're Well, I used to work with a guy who also did this for Cox. He wrote the Gold Book, which was an early price guide, and he was an inventor, an engineer. He worked at Bell Laboratories in New Jersey. Wow. And had patents. And John characterized what we all do when we look at cars at auctions as a game of attributions. He's a very analytical guy. And he would, you know, the answer is you look at the car and you look for the things that you can see that you can't experience and you can't see closely, and then you try to infer from what you see to what the car has been through, what the rest of the car is like. Is the transmission full of sawdust? Well, you don't know, but if the car is haphazardly and superficially done, then it immediately goes from being a beautiful paint job and a nice interior to being something that is questionable.
Right. So let me ask you this. So in your database over the years, and then I'm going to ask you, how many cars do you pick? Do you get all the cars at the auction? Because I know when I used to be an auction analysis reporter for Sports Car Market, so they would say, Robert, we need you to go get 50, 60 cars, write about those cars. And then over time, these cars would be assimilated into their database. And then, you know, over a 3 or 4 or 5 year period of time, you'd see that some of these cars were actually commodities, and they would just get bought and sold and bought and sold and bought and sold. So they never really had a home. They were just kind of traded, you know, like I said, a commodity. So over the years that you've done this, do you run across this quite a bit? And what's your procedure as far as, you know, cars that you follow? And when you go to an auction, let's say, like, for example, you were out there in California with us, you know, at Gooding or RM or Meekum or whatever. How do you determine which cars you're going to write about and collect in your and add to your, assimilate into your database, so to speak?
Yeah, I can't do every car.
No.
There were, by my count, over 1,100 cars in the Monterey auctions.
Mm-hmm.
Most, you know, the vast majority of them, or not the vast majority of them, but certainly the largest contingent being at Meekum.
Right.
And you just can't write them all up. I write up as many as I can, and I try to go around and look at cars that I think tell me something about the marketplace.
Okay.
Cars that I think are intriguing and fun, cars that are interesting. So at Gooding, for example, I wrote up the Tourist Trophy Sunbeam, which is, you know, an ancient gold crock of a car, but a really historic and interesting car with technical excellence and design characteristics that set it apart from most of its competitors in 1914. And then I look at cars that tell me something about the market. So an MGA or a Shelby Cobra or a GT350 or a 58 Corvette. And they give me an insight and frankly help Hagerty produce the price guide, because they tell us something about more common cars that have a story about the market and what is going on. This year, for example, I wrote up a whole bunch of 300 SLs. There were a whole bunch of 300 SLs in Monterey.
Yeah.
In the auctions. And watching the 300 SL, both the Gullwing and the Roadster over the years, you see them go up, you see them come down, you see them go back up again, you see them come back down. And that kind of gives us, particularly since we know, or we at least assess, what the condition of the car is and what its history is. Does it have its original engine and that sort of stuff? It gives us an opportunity to sort of translate what we see in specific transactions into a view of the market as a whole. And that's what I'm trying to do, as well as, frankly, hitting the top of the market, the high-profile cars that everybody's interested in, and a few others that are just intriguing and interesting.
So what's your pulse on the market right now?
It's soft.
It's soft, really?
Oh, yeah.
What would you say it's off by?
You know, it's not a big number.
10%, 20%?
Yeah, 10, 15, I don't think it even gets to 20. And it's spotty. Some cars are off more than other cars are. And I won't hazard a guess for you as much as you'd like me to on the program about what they are, because I'm still working my way through all of the auction reports from Monterey. I'm not done yet. But there were cars in Monterey that sold happily, I think, but sold for less than what they had sold within the last year or two.
Well, you know, I've had this discussion with a lot of car collectors, and yourself being a car collector, you know, those of us that are in it, we kind of understand a little bit from the collector and the business side of it. And the one comment you always tell people: you buy the car because you want the car, because you like the car, because you can afford the car. Okay, if it goes up, it's a bonus. If it goes down, you can still live with the car because you got something you like. So, unfortunately, I think, and I'm not going to name anybody in particular, but you know, I think that the auctions have really kind of turned the collector car hobby into a commodity. And so people don't think they look at it like true collector cars. And we got about 10 minutes left, and I know you dying to talk about this, and so am I. And that's the Bugatti, the 59 that was at Pebble Beach, okay? And I was out of all, you know how you go to a car show and you just happen to walk past a car and you said, that's the car. It ticks all the boxes, you know, checks all the boxes. That was the car for me. Because, I mean, you see all these beautiful cars there, but when you see something unusual like that, we'll get into that in a second. But anyway, go ahead and elaborate on what I just said as far as, do you think that the auctions have kind of contributed to this collector car hobby being kind of more of a commodity more than anything else nowadays? You know, when you're talking about SLs going up, SLs going down, Jags going up, Jags going down, Ferraris going up, Ferraris going down, and so on.
I think they respond,
okay,
to the way in which people are collecting cars. I don't know that they actually drive it, although in Monterey, in many cases, there were cars that sold for way under their estimated range.
Yes.
And that, to me, means that the auction company and the consigners, is a shared responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
Take a car, put it in their auction docket, put up a glorified estimate for it, write a wonderful catalog description, and yet the consigner knows and the auction company knows that in the current market the car is worth a lot less money. And so it has a reasonable reserve on it, and yet the reasonable reserve is 50 or 60 or 75% of the low estimate on the car. And I think that in some cases contributes. I think it contributes to sucking people who don't do their research, who don't take the time to understand and research the values of the cars that they're interested in, and sucks them into believing that a car is worth $600,000 when it's going to sell for $350,000. And I think that's a disservice to the collector. We look at the auction companies as being informed and knowledgeable, and they are, but fail to to recognize that their job and what they are contracted to do with the consigners is to get the highest price for the car that they possibly can. And so the whole hype, the auctioneer's hype, the catalog descriptions, the presentation at the auction is all based on getting people enthusiastic and getting them to raise their hand and hopefully getting into a bidding contest with somebody else who is equally enthusiastic and equally has not done the research to bid enthusiastically for a car.
Okay, well said. I like that. That's good. Let's talk about, well, you know what the problem was? They did not go to rickcarey.com and look up the collector car auction report. That was the problem. See, if they had gone to that, they would have would have been informed.
Yeah.
Rick, let's talk about that beautiful, stunning Survivor Bentley. You had a chance. I looked at the car, but you had
Wait. You said Bentley. You meant Bugatti.
Excuse me, Bugatti. I'm sorry. I stand corrected. But you had the opportunity to talk to the gentleman, and you've got way more information on that car than I do. But please share that, because that, to me, was like the car. I mean, it was such an unusual piece. And I don't know how many of those cars they made. Was it like 4 or 5 of those cars, 10 of those cars? But there was
Under 10. I don't remember the exact number. It was a Type 59 Grand Prix car. And most of them were raced by the factory, by the Bugatti team. This one had no significant race history. And after Bugatti moved on, it was converted by the factory into a two-seater. It was originally a single-seat, center-drive position Grand Prix car, or that was how it was intended. And they converted it to a two-seat car, put a sports car body on it with cycle fenders, provisions for headlights, and sold it on to, I forget who the first owner of the car was, but it eventually went to King Leopold of Belgium. And he raced that car. So the King of Belgium actually raced that car as a sports car, and probably in Grand Prix races. Again, I don't recall exactly. And then held on to it. I mean, he painted it black. It was matte black with a gold stripe down each side, a narrow gold stripe, which were the racing colors of Belgium. And it sat for years. And as you and I know, because we looked at the car at Pebble Beach, along the edges, the paint was chipped.
Yes.
And underneath it was the original Bugatti blue paint that it had got when it was new. It still had its original paint under the matte black finish. I mean, just an amazing piece of history.
So the gentleman that had it, who was from Switzerland, how did he acquire the car? Did you get that part of the story? I stood there and I was waiting for an opportunity to talk to him, but I was waiting for somebody else, and then my guy showed up and then got off in a la la land, and then when I went back, the guy wasn't standing around the car because he was wearing that hat. He was kind of a tall guy, well dressed. And what amazed me is when he was walking around the car and people were, he was so enthusiastic about that car, it was unbelievable. And the fact he was like thrilled to be there, to be on the lawn on the 18th fairway there at Pebble, just to even get there is a feat in itself. But the fact that I thought was that car won. Like Bill Warner, and you know Bill, I think Bill does the best job. He's got a pre-war car and a post-war car. I think that's ideal for a concourse. Pebble still is old school, but the fact that they didn't put a shiny Mercedes or a shiny Maserati or Ferrari or Duesenberg or V16 Cadillac or Packard, which is historically always won there, the fact that they picked this particular car in the condition that it was, And as historically significant as that car was, to me, I thought that was fantastic. That's all I can tell you.
I walked around the field. I always, as I do every year, I walk the field, I take a bunch of pictures, I talk to people, I hang around. And then just before I leave, I walk through the field and I say, what is the best of show? What is going to be the best of show? And I walked the field and I looked at all these cars. And frankly, I walked right by the Bugatti. As wonderful as it was, as much as I loved the car, I didn't consider it had a chance for best of show. And my choice was Harry Yagi's Packard V12 boat tail speedster, which was a gorgeous, beautiful restored car. It was one of the four in line to get best of show at Pebble, but it didn't make it. And that's, I think, the real significance of the Bugatti Type 59, which, by the way, has a Type 57 chassis number.
Oh, really?
Yeah, when they sold it, they said, well, you know, a Type 59, who knows what they said, but they probably said, well, a Type 59 is a Grand Prix car. We're selling this as a two-seater, so we're going to call it a Type 57. Being the manufacturer, they stamped a Type 57 chassis number on it, and that's what it wears today.
Interesting. Didn't I know that? You know, I was there for the Dawn Patrol early on in the morning, because I usually go to that. And, you know, they had the group of cars going there, and then Sandra and her husband, Neil, they hand out the booklets and everything like that and the cards. And when that car rolled in, I said, because I saw it when it came into the Tour de Elegance the day before, 2 days before. And then when I saw it roll up there, the fact that it just rolled up, I don't know, there was something about it. I just said, that's my kind of car. That should win best of show. And because it was so unusual, and like to your point, you know, in the past, it's always been Packard, Zuzenbergs, and cars like that. I mean, even Delahays and Delages don't always win, and so those win every once in a while, stuff like that. But I think that they get the more unique cars, and now the fact that they understand a car that's truly in the preservation class, which, like we all say in the biz, it's only original one time.
Yep.
And that, to me, just speaks volumes.
Yes, I think you're absolutely correct. And, you know, when they first started Pebble Beach in 1950, I think, 51, it was a show where people brought new cars.
Yes.
And showed off new cars. And back then, you could be best of show with a new 1950 Cadillac. But over the years, it has evolved into this showpiece of beyond perfect restoration of big, limited production, beautiful, fast cars. And the Type 59 is beautiful and fast and fairly big.
Yep. And unique.
And, yeah, absolutely unique and just a wonderful survivor that teaches us that
Rick,
it's not necessary to be perfect.
Well said. Rick, we are up against the clock. I want to thank you very much for hanging out with us here at Nostalgic Radio and Cars. I didn't realize how time runs with, you know. But anyway, if you want to find out more about Rick Carey, go to rickcarey.com. Collector Car Auction Reports. Rick, thank you very much. We'll have to do this again, all right? I want you back on the show, and we'll talk more about collector cars and stuff. In the meantime, thank you very much for hanging out with us here at Nostalgic Radio and Cars. All my friends, check us out here every Tuesday between 7 and 8 p.m. on the Centauk Radio Network. Stay safe, drive carefully, and love your family.
WTAN Clearwater.
FM 106.1.
WDCF Dade City.
FM 102.3.
Listen.